Democracy and Human Depravity was presented by David Crabtree at Gutenberg College's 2010 Summer Institute entitled Democracy, a User's Manual. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
My job is to try to describe the biblical perspective on the weaknesses of democracy. I did a word study on democracy. Got zero hits. So I got to go a different route here. It's supposed to be the biblical view on mankind and therefore the weakness of democracy. I decided to go one better. I'm going to give you my view. It is kind of daunting to have to give the biblical view of anything. And seriously, it is my project to try to understand the biblical perspective on life as a whole and integrate that with my thinking. And so the best I can do really is to give you my most current understanding of what man is like and what that tells us about the weakness of democracy. And it's up to you then to sort that out and critique it and decide whether I'm biblical or not. Any perspective in political science that tries to figure out a form of government that's going to work has to start out with a realistic view of what man is, because man is the building block of any society. If you don't have a good picture of what a man is, then you are going to come up with a political system that will not work. And so it's the more accurate your understanding of what a human being is like, the more likely you're going to be able to come up with a political system that will work. One of the things that I find interesting in looking at the political scientists over the years, including someone like Karl Marx, is he tried to start out with man as man is, at least in his understanding of what man is. But he didn't understand what man is and ended up with a system that I think does not work. The tendency is to either romanticize what a human being is or to think that with the right system, man can be changed, that man is infinitely pliable. But it makes more sense to look at what man actually is and then think about that in terms of a political system. Okay. It was difficult for me to figure out what to say and how to organize my thoughts. It was particularly challenging. So what I've decided to do is I'm going to just go through the key characteristics of human beings as I understand them from the biblical perspective and try to chart out a portrait of what a human being is like. What is the nature of human being? And then just list some implications of that for democracy. And my hope is that then we can just turn it into a conversation among ourselves and go beyond my list and critique what I have said and build on that. As I think about the nature of human beings from the biblical perspective, it seems to me that the most helpful passage is the first couple chapters of, first three chapters of Genesis. And so that's largely what my comments will be drawn from. I'm not actually going to go through those chapters. There is one section that I'm going to look at. I'll actually read to you and we'll talk about it a little bit more. But that's largely the backdrop for my comments. The first characteristic of man that I would list is that man was made a moral being. What I mean by that, it says that God made man in the form and image of himself, in his own form and image. So what does it mean that God made man in his image? Well, there's something that is similar between man and God. There's something that's retained. Obviously, not everything is retained. We are not like God. We are not just like God. We are only his image. There's only a certain amount of who he is that has been preserved in human beings. And the question is, what is the nature of that imageness that we contain? And it seems to me that at the heart of that is that we are moral beings. God made us to be moral beings. There are several hints of that in the Genesis passage, I think. Genesis, especially the early chapters of Genesis, are all about right and wrong. It is a moral context. Later on, we have Cain killing Abel. But then Adam has another son, Seth, who is appointed. And the text goes out of its way to say that Seth was in the form and image of Adam. And I think what we are to understand there is that it is a moral context for that statement. It isn't that Seth had the same red hair that Adam had, but rather that Seth reflected the moral image of his father. So I think the whole context of the first few chapters of Genesis is pointing us in the direction of understanding that at the heart of man's God imageness is the fact that he was created to be a moral being. I think that that's also reflected in the fact that Jesus is, in a sense, even more in the image of God than was Adam. But what was it about Jesus that was godlike? Well, there are a number of things, but I think that it all centers around the fact that Jesus was morally perfect. That's at the heart of it. It's as if God is saying, what I would most like to tell people about me is my moral nature. If there's one thing that I'm particularly proud of, if there's one thing that's particularly distinctive about me, is my moral nature. And that's what I'm going to preserve in the making of man, and that's what I preserve even more fully in Jesus. No. What I think was Adam was a moral being. That is, he was made to be the kind of being that makes moral choices. Jesus is not only a moral being, he is a pure moral being. That is, he was sinless. He made good moral choices. As a result, then, it seems to me that we see that in our everyday experience. Every human being is interested in, I could say justice, but the way it's usually is expressed is with a different word, and that's fairness. I used to have a discussion group that I had with young kids. We'd read a section of the Old Testament and we'd talk about it. And it was hard to get them to discuss. But one trick that I discovered early on is if you talk about fairness, they're interested. And it works like a charm. That is a topic that they love to talk about. Everybody has some concept of fairness, and it's important to them. I think that's curious. Why would that be? And I think the reason is we were made moral beings. Now, the fact that we were made moral beings means that we need to have certain other characteristics that make us competent moral beings, that is, the right kind of beings to make moral choices. And so I think there are other qualities that human beings have that are related to the fact that God wanted to make us as moral beings. And those include, one, we are rational. In the ancients, Aristotle, he thought rationality was the most distinctive feature of human beings. Well, I don't think it's the most distinctive, but it is distinctive. But it is, God made us to be rational because he wanted us to be competent moral beings. And in order to be the kind of being that makes moral decisions, we had to be rational. So rationality is a part of that package. We had to be decision makers. So God made us the kinds of beings that make decisions in life. We had to be actors, competent actors, that is, beings that do things, that perform actions. We had to have a sense of meaning and purpose that's related to the moral questions that we have to deal with. And he also made us social beings, beings who want to associate with our own kind, because that is the forum in which most of our moral decisions are made. It's an interaction with other human beings. And I'm sure that the list could go on, but there are a whole complex of qualities that human beings have that make them good moral choosers. And that's what God wanted to accomplish. So, man is a moral being, and I think that is his most distinctive quality. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, man is finite. Very finite. Finite, even vulnerable, and small. That we are just, relative to the forces of the universe, we are insects. We are just little bugs. One of my favorite things to do is going to the ocean and playing in the waves and going out where the surf is fairly high and where I'm completely above the sand and trying to body surf if possible. I rarely achieve any success in that, but the thing that I like about it is the feeling of power that you get from those waves coming and crashing on you. And whenever I do that, it always causes me to reflect on how powerful it is and how relatively weak I am. It's just amazing. And it does that day after day, year after year, all the time. It just keeps pounding. Look at the rocks. Look at the rocks at Yahats. Look what it's done to those. It just keeps pounding those things. Well, that's only one of the forces that's out there. There are other forces that are out there, and they are all capable of squashing me very easily. So, as a human being, we are just little itty-bitty critters in this vast universe and relatively powerless. I think that we lose sight of that as city people. We lose track of the vastness of what's out there and the forces that are out there. I mean, just the fact that we can't see the stars in the city, I think, is unfortunate. I think being able to see the stars is a good reminder of how little we are. And to think about the wilderness and to see animals that aren't in zoos. I mean, I've often thought, if you go to a zoo and you see a lion in a cage, have you seen a lion? And I think the answer is no, you haven't seen a lion. Because if you look at a lion and it doesn't send shivers up your spine, you haven't seen a lion. And we're protected from all of that. So we have this, we lose that vision of how small and finite we are. And I think that's unfortunate. Related to that is we are limited intellectually. We may be rational beings, but we are relatively ignorant. There's a lot out there to be known, and of that, we know an infinitesimal amount. And it doesn't matter how old you are, how much you've learned, you know an infinitesimal part amount of what's out there. Which means that we can't secure our future. We can't really take care of ourselves in a way that's satisfying and we can rest assured, I've taken care of myself. We don't know what's out there. We don't know what's coming. We don't know how to deal with what's out there. We are, however, capable learners, and we can roll back that ignorance. We can overcome that to a certain extent, but even if we spend our whole life learning again, we've only learned an infinitesimal amount. So we're moral beings. We are finite, and in particular, we are finite intellectually. We are rebels against God. Man decided from the very beginning that God was not ultimately trustworthy. That when it comes down to deciding whether I am going to take my own life in my hands or I'm going to entrust my life in God's hands, that the former is preferable. In the former, I know that my interests will be taken into account. That was the decision in the garden, and that's been the decision that every human being since then has made, with one exception. And what that means is, at the heart of that rebellion is, we can't trust God. God cannot be trusted with our own, with our self-interests. We are the better locus for that concern. Which means that we are these little creatures in this big universe, big, daunting universe, and we have turned our back on our greatest aid in dealing with this reality. Our biggest helper in dealing with this reality, God Himself. Which means we're faced with our finitude in this vast universe, and that's scary. So human beings are inherently then insecure, worried about their well-being and worried about their future. That's the nature of being a human being. And chronically discontented. Now, related to that rebellion against God, there's another characteristic, and that is we are foolish. And by foolishness, I mean something different from ignorance. Those are very different. Ignorance is just a limited amount of knowledge. Foolishness is a heart condition. Foolishness is a refusal to accept God and His guidance. And therefore, a refusal to recognize what is true. So ignorance can be solved by knowledge. Foolishness cannot. Foolishness is a spiritual problem. Okay, so what happens when you put this collection of characteristics together into a human being? What results from that? What results is that we have a creature that is worldly self-interested or short-term self-interested. That is, human beings are concerned about their well-being in this world and have a difficult time seeing beyond that. What will suit my purposes in this world? What will secure my fate in this world? So man is capable. He has rationality. He can do a lot of things. But he's insecure. So he's constantly maneuvering and trying to figure out how to control his circumstances, how to control the environment around him, and to conform it to his liking. As a result, if we look at the history of mankind, the amount of progress that man has made in his ability to manipulate the environment, it is astounding. It is truly astounding. The example that comes to my mind immediately whenever I think about this is when I was a freshman at the University of Pennsylvania, I took a math class which had a computer component to it, which was a new thing. And so we had to write, once a week we had to write a simple program in Fortran. And in those days, to write a computer program meant to take these cards and you punch holes, type them out, and it punches holes in the card. And so a program consisted of this deck of cards that you have hopefully accurately typed. And you take this deck of cards to the computer, and the computer all day long was used to run things for the university, but at night they would run student programs. So you'd take the deck to the computer center, and at night they would run it, and in the morning you'd go back and you'd get this printout of your program and when you run it, what happened. So then you go through the debugging process, which always took me about a week because I'd find one bug and fix that, and then I have to turn my cards in and go through the whole process again. But the computer consisted of one city block, a building that occupied one whole city block. Now I carry around in my backpack a laptop that is probably 1,000 times more powerful than that city block in Philadelphia. Astounding. And there are other things. I mean, that's my backpack. My computer is not the most up-to-date technological advance. So what is being achieved is just mind-boggling. It really is. Human beings are capable of doing phenomenal things. And think of things like gene splitting. Just astounding. Absolutely astounding. So, man has made huge strides in his ability to control his environment. Just look at any city. What an astounding difference that is from being out in a cave. So on the one hand, that's what we see, and history is the story of man becoming more and more competent in that respect. But the other aspect of it is he is chronically wrong-headed. He is constantly doing things that on the one hand improve his environment, but on the other hand make things worse. It's the unintended consequences of the development, of the advances that he makes. And I'm convinced that that's exactly what God had intended, and God will continue to guarantee that man will fail. If you look at Genesis 3, after Adam and Eve have eaten of the fruit that God told them not to eat from, God comes to them and he proclaims a curse on the serpent. And then he talks to the woman, and then he talks to the man. Interestingly, just as a side comment, it never says that God cursed Adam, and it never says that God cursed Eve. He curses the serpent, and he curses the ground, but he doesn't curse man. But what he says is bad news nevertheless. Chapter 3, verse 16, to the woman he says, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbirth. In pain you shall bring forth children, yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. I think what's happening here is God is giving Eve two snapshots. It's just two examples of how life is going to be as she progresses through life, what it's going to look like. And the snapshots, both of the snapshots, consist of God telling her, you will have this particular desire. And I'll, just as a side note, I believe these are desires that were built into Eve, built into women, and then we'll see two that are built into Adam. These are desires that are built into human beings. But what God is saying is, and you won't be able to satisfy those. So to Eve, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbirth. The implied desire there is for children. To have and raise children. A great desire given by God to human beings. But the pain in childbirth and pain you shall bring forth children, that it is going to be a painful process to give birth to and raise those children. So getting fulfillment from that is going to be frustrated. The other desire says, your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. She will have a desire to be united with her husband as one, but because of sin, getting satisfaction for that desire to be united with a man is going to be frustrated. Then he speaks to Adam. Then to Adam he said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree about which I commanded you, saying you shall not eat from it, cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall grow for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. And I think we have two more snapshots here. One is, you need to eat. You have a God-given desire for food, but that's going to be not just food, but work. You have a God-given desire for productive activity, but it will be difficult to get satisfaction for that. You're going to be faced with thistles and thorns and the sweat of your brow. And the other snapshot, you're going to die. The implied desire there, I think, that's built into man, is the desire for immortality. That we all have a desire, we wish, we would like to be significant, to be permanent, not just be fleeting. And yet the ultimate futility of that is we're all going to die. So I think what we see here is God's strategy to man's rebelliousness is, you've got desires that were built into you by me from creation, and I am going to guarantee that you will not truly be able to gain satisfaction from those things. I'm going to guarantee your failure in that respect. The result of that, I think, is then we see man constantly trying to find fulfillment, trying to find satisfaction in his life, trying to find a sense of accomplishment and achieving his ultimate goals, and God constantly frustrating those. And the history of mankind, I think, can be lays that out. The history of mankind, I think, can best be described as being driven by man's insecurity, constantly trying to solve his problem and not being able to do it. As a result, man is constantly doing things that are self-defeating, self-destructive, without knowing it necessarily. The one of the most interesting symptom of man's nature, I think, in my mind, is the development of computer viruses. Think, what a bizarre thing. We've got computers that and they're networked together, and it could be a phenomenal thing, a truly phenomenal thing. But is it not interesting that people seem led to act in a way that sabotages that whole project? Why would people create things that just destroy? What a phenomenal example of the character that man has. Man is so confused that he is driven to self-destruction. One of the things that has been striking to me in the Gutenberg curriculum and looking through the history of ideas is you see this constant pattern that goes right through history, where each generation will look at the previous generation and say, they got it wrong. And oftentimes, they are accurate. There was something wrong there. But what is consistently the case is they don't understand the problem of the previous generation quite right, and the solution that they propose generally ends up making things worse rather than better. So we end up on this constant cycle of taking acts that send us in an even further in the wrong direction. And we create, in our competence, in our creativity, we create things, tools, constantly that we start using and we can't not use them. We have to keep going with it, keep developing it further and further. And even if it's ultimately wrong-headed. In light of our recent economic situation, I have an illustration, but I will preface it by saying I don't really know what I'm talking about, but that has never stopped me from using these illustrations. But one of the books that we look at in the curriculum is Keynes's book on the general theory of unemployment, where the book that he wrote addressing the problem of unemployment in the Great Depression. And what Keynes was saying is unemployment is a very painful thing for society have to endure, especially high unemployment. And we've got to be able we've got to figure out a way to deal with that problem. So what Keynes argued is that there are tools that are available to the state to address that problem such that we won't have those wild fluctuations of unemployment and then periods when the economy is superheated. And so he suggested using increased government spending in times when unemployment gets high and the economy has cooled down. You use high government spending, and that means either printing money or borrowing money in order to spend that. And then at times when the economy is superheated, then you tax additionally, you raise taxes. Well, those are powerful tools that Keynes introduced, made available to modern societies. To my knowledge, states only use the one and not the other. The greater spending when the economy gets slow, but raising taxes when the economy is going well, I'm not sure that that's done consistently. But what's interesting is Keynes was talking about using these only in extreme circumstances because Keynes was essentially very Smithian. He was a real disciple of Adam Smith and Adam Smith's perspective. So Keynes is talking about something that you only pull out in emergencies. Well, it is so predictable that what would happen with that tool is that you start out, you only use it way up here and way down here, but as time goes on, people's ability to withstand pain decreases, and pretty soon you've got the government using those tools to micromanage the economy to keep it within very narrow range and to build on those tools and use other what are called micro or macroeconomic tools. Of course it was going to happen. Man can't have a powerful tool introduced and not use it to its fullest extent. And so when we get into things like gene splicing and that sort of thing, of course it's going to happen. Just as a side comment with respect to Keynesian economics, I think economists should take a lesson from the ecologists or biologists, because I suspect that what we have done with macroeconomics is similar to what the Forest Service did with fire controls in the forests. That if you go in and put out every fire as soon as it starts, you are, in the long run, building up a situation in which you're going to have an absolute conflagration. And I suspect with macroeconomics, we're getting headed for the same kind of problem. Okay, so if that's the kind of thing that man is, then what are the implications of that for democracy? And I'm going to list about a half dozen things, and then we can throw it open and talk about other implications. The first is that man has a propensity to want to build power bases. He is small and insecure, and in this big universe, he would like nothing better than to build up some kind of power base that is responsive to his needs. And what does that end up? And interestingly, in Genesis, what does Cain do after God tells him that he will be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth and sends him out? He goes and he builds a city. It's the first thing that he does. So building a power base. And by the way, Jacques Ellul wrote a book called The Meaning of the City. I highly recommend it because he traces through the Bible the significance of this thing, a city. It's very interesting. And then you have the story of the Tower of Babel. Once again, it's this project of bringing together a lot of people to work on a common project, and it's a kind of intoxication about what man can achieve if we work together and the power that can be generated by that. So man, in his insecurity, is driven to want to create these kinds of power bases that are responsive to his needs. And in modern times, what has that become? That's become the state. The state is what we look to constantly to be that thing that will solve our problems. And that's, Ellul's going to talk about that in the reading for tomorrow. So we're constantly wanting to give the state more power so that it can be more helpful to us. But as we give the state more power, then the state eventually begins to look a little ominous. It looks oppressive. So then man steps back and says, I don't know if we want this, if you can step back. And so we have these transformations of the state. We have these revolutions. But as de Tocqueville argues and as Solzhenitsyn argues, ultimately revolutions don't change much. And Ellul, especially in talking about the French Revolution, is saying the trends that led up to the French Revolution are only slightly interrupted by the French Revolution, and those trends continue full force afterwards. But when we're talking about the basic trends in a society, those aren't affected by a revolution. And Ellul argues you don't have the state losing power. The state accumulates and accumulates, and you can have revolutions or whatever you want to do, but when it comes to grabbing power back from the state, that does not happen to a significant degree. Once it's given over, you don't get it back. So we have the situation in which we are very willingly giving power to the state to have it grow. We get scared, and there may be things that happen, whether it's a revolution or a slight kind of appearance of moving back, but the general trend is more and more power to the state. So he wants to build power bases, and that will happen in a democracy. That is even easier to achieve in a democracy than it might be in some other forms of government. Man is not restrained by principles. Ultimately, man doesn't care about principles. Man is interested in self-interest, in his own peace and security. That's unfortunate, because in a democracy, you need a principled populace. You need a populace with self-discipline that is able to restrain itself from going in directions that are attractive but ultimately destructive. And furthermore, if you have an unprincipled population, then there is no set of checks and balances that ultimately can keep democracy within its bounds. There will always be a way around them, as we're witnessing. The third quality, man is extremely manipulable. He is easily led astray and is inclined to be led in certain wrong directions just inherently. If you look back at the account in Genesis, Eve was led to eat the fruit, but only because she was inclined to eat the fruit. That the serpent tapped into an inclination that was already there. And it was an inclination in a direction that she kind of wanted to go anyway. Jacques Ellul, in his book Propaganda, I'm really pushing Jacques Ellul today, in preparation for tomorrow. In his book Propaganda, he makes a number of very interesting points, but one of them that was most striking to me is the reason you have propaganda is because we have people who want to be propagandized. That propaganda is only possible because we kind of want it. And what Alul goes on to argue is that in the modern society, we have created an environment in which human beings are particularly in the market for being propagandized. And just very briefly, what he argues is modern culture, modern society has stripped human beings of the kinds of things that they had in times more ancient, further back, that gave them a sense of purpose, a sense of place, a sense of importance. That those kinds of things we all need, and those kinds of things were provided in cultures before modern culture in various ways. But in modern culture, we have taken away all of the structures that used to provide people with those things. Which means now human beings are more lost. They're more alone. They're more confused. They're more needy. And the propagandist comes along and says, give me your loyalty and I will give you meaning, place, and significance. So that's the bargain that the propagandist offers. And Alul says, in modern society, that's irresistible. So man is very manipulable. He wants to be manipulated in certain directions. As Alul points out, propaganda can't lead people in just any direction. It's only a certain set of directions that propaganda can lead people. The fourth thing, man is fickle. He's not tied by principle. He's not tied by ideology. He's not tied by a firm sense of purpose and meaning. And as a result, the public opinion will turn on a dime. He doesn't really know what he needs or how to get it, so he's always in the market for something that will satisfy. The fifth thing, he is constantly probing for his personal advantage. There are people that are constantly looking for ways that they can benefit themselves throughout the society all the time. And the illustration that comes to mind for this is young computer hackers in Russia. In Russia, it is common for young boys to get on their computers and get on the internet and just probe and see what they can get into and see what bank accounts they can get or see what defense secrets they can find or what companies they can mess up or all that sort of thing. And in some instances, they are rewarded and encouraged by the Russian government to do that in non-Russian areas. But just think about all these young hackers just kind of constantly testing to see where there is some place that they can get in and do some mischief. Well, that's what we're like in American society. It's the same kind of thing, that people are constantly maneuvering and looking for where they might get a slight edge or might get a slight advantage. And that's happening constantly all over the place. And the result is, over time, an interest in the common goodwill is replaced with personal advantage as a society as a whole. And then the last thing I want to point out is We are blind to our true situation. We are blind to who we truly are and what we're like. And that's why, for the political scientists, it's so hard to figure out what is the building block of a society, because we're so blind to the reality of our situation and who we are. And that blindness is not a blindness of ignorance, but rather it's a blindness of foolishness. It's that we don't want to know the truth.